Side 14, The Boat of a Million Years by Paul Anderson, continuing on page 409. Pythias calculated it. If we change direction now, we can reach them in about a dozen years ship's time. It's 300 light years more than we planned, but we are still at close to light speed and a dozen little years to meet the Ferrers of the galaxy. But we only had 4 to go. 4 years longer to our home. Dushan knotted his fists on the tabletop. How far from it would you take us? Hanno hesitated. Svoboda answered, Between 3 and Phaeacia's sun is about 300 light years, from a standing start, 16 or 17 ship years. We won't abandon our original purpose, only postpone it. The hell you say, Wanderer rapped. Whichever star we go to, we'll need more antimatter before we can take off for anywhere else. Building the production plant and then making the stuff, that's probably 10 years by itself. The aliens should have plenty on hand. Should they? And will they share it freely, just like that? How do you know? How can you tell what they want of us anyway? Wait, wait, Makandal broke in. Let's not get paranoid. Whatever they are, it can't be monsters or bandits or anything evil. At their stage of civilization, that wouldn't make sense. Now who's being cocksure? Aliat shrilled. What do we know about Star 3? Yukiko asked. Her quietness smoothed bristles down a little. Hanno shook his head. Not much, beyond its type and inferred age, he admitted. Being normal, it's bound to have planets, but we have no information on them. Never been visited. My God, a sphere 800 or 900 light-years across holds something like 100,000 stars. But you say this one's not so bright as ours, Makandal reminded him. Then the chances that it's got a planet where we could breathe are poor, even with much better candidates. The table thudded beneath Dushan's smiting. That is what matters, he said. After 15 weary years we were promised we shall walk free on living ground. You would keep us locked in this hull for 8 years longer than that, and then at journey's end we still would be for decades or centuries or forever. No. But this chance we cannot pass it by, Svoboda protested. Wanderer spoke crisply. We won't. Once we get to Phaeacia, we'll have the robots build us a proper transceiver and send a beam to 3. Start conversation. Eventually we'll go there in person, those of us who care to. Or maybe the aliens will come to us. Hanno's countenance was stark. I told you it's about 300 light-years between Phaeacia and 3, he said. Wanderer shrugged. We have time ahead of us. If Phaeacia doesn't kill us first, we were never guaranteed safety there, you know. Earth should be getting in touch, too, once we've informed them, Makandal said. Svoboda's tone lashed. Yes, by beam, and by robots that beam back. Who but us will ever go in person and get to know the others as they are? It is true, Yukiko said. Words and pictures alone, with centuries between, are good, but they are not enough. I think we here should understand that better than our fellow humans. We knew the dead of long ago as living bodies, minds, souls. To everyone else, what are they but relics and words? Svoboda regarded her. Then you want to set for Star 3? Yes, oh yes. Dushan's look upon her was stricken. Do you say that, Small Snow? Morning glory. He straightened. Well, it shall not be. Absolutely not, Patulcius vowed. We have our community to found. Aliat caught his arm and leaned close against him. Her eyes defied Hanno. Our homes to make, she said. Makandal nodded. It's a hard decision, but we should go to Phaeacia first. And last, Hanno retorted, I tell you, if we let this chance escape us, we can very well never get it back. Do you want to change your mind, Peregrino? Wanderer sat expressionless for a while before he answered. It is a hard decision, after all. The greatest, most important adventure in history, which we risk losing, against what may be New Earth, a fresh start for our race. Which is better, the forest or the stars? Again he was mute, brooding. Abruptly, well, I said it before. The stars can wait. 4-3, Dushan reckoned triumphant. We continue as we were. Softening, I am sorry, friends. Hanno's voice, face, bearing, went altogether bleak. I was afraid of this. Please think again. I have had centuries to think, Dushan said. To wish for the earth of the past, you mean, Yukiko told him. An earth that never really was. No, you wouldn't deny humankind such a chance for knowledge, for coming closer to oneness with the universe. That would be nothing but selfish. You are not a selfish person, dear. He shook his head, ox-stubborn. Humankind has waited a long time for contact, and on the whole has not actually shown much interest, Patulkius said. It can wait a while longer. Our first duty is to the children we shall have, and can have only on Phaeacia. They can better wait than this can, Svoboda argued. What we learn from the aliens, the help they give us, should make us the more secure when we do take our new home. The opportunity may well be unique, Hanno joined in. I repeat, the aliens at 3 are likely few and pretty newly arrived, else the web at Sol would have picked up trace of them, or spacecraft of theirs would have arrived there. But we simply don't know. Are they necessarily settled at 3? If we don't accept their invitation, and they have no way of telling whether we've gotten it, will they stay or will they move on? And will they necessarily move on towards Sol? Will they necessarily still be at 3 when we come? Countered Makandal. If they are, will they necessarily be anything we can communicate with? No, it's a long, dangerous detour for the sake of something that may be grand, but may just as well prove futile. Let's get on with our real business first. As the computers and overlords on Earth planned for us, Hanno jibed. He turned toward Wanderer. Wouldn't you, Peregrino, like for once to do something that wasn't planned, that broke through the whole damned scheme of the world today? The other man sighed. A tough call. Yes, I want to go to 3 so bad I can taste it. And some day I hope to. But first and foremost, free life in a free nature. Pleadingly. And I couldn't do it to Corinne and Aliat. I just can't. You're a knight, Aliat breathed. Yukiko smiled sadly. Well, Hanno, Svoboda, we 3 are no worse off than we were yesterday, are we? Better, in fact, with a new dream before us. For some day, Svoboda mumbled. She lifted her head. I am not angry with you, my friends. I, too, am weary of machines and hungry for land. So be it. The tension began to ease. Smiles flickered. No, said Hanno. Attention stabbed at him. He rose. I am more sorry than you'll ever guess, he stated. But I believe our need and our duty have changed. They are to go to 3. Till now this venture was desperate. We pretended otherwise, but it was. Our chances looked about equal for perishing as miserably as the Norse did in Greenland, or settling into a sameness like the Polynesians in the Pacific. You promoted it, Patulkius virtually accused. Because I was desperate, too. We all were. At least we'd be trying. We might, against the odds, eventually fill our planet with people who kept on looking and searching outward. What had we to lose? Well, this day, we've discovered what? The universe. I am the captain. I am taking us to the others. Dushan was first onto his own feet. You can't, he bellowed. I can, Hanno said. Pythias obeys me. I will order the course change at once. The sooner it's made, the sooner— No, not against our will, Wanderer interrupted. It would be wrong, Yukiko pleaded. Svoboda regarded Hanno with something akin to horror. You don't mean what you said, she stammered. Don't you want me to do this? He cast back. Her jaw clenched. Not like that. No, I suppose you wouldn't. Still, I am going to issue the order. You will thank me afterward. Forgemoy, she raised her voice. Pythias, you won't heed a single man, will you? He is captain, replied the ship. I must. No matter what, Patulcius shouted. Impossible. Such is the programming. You never told us, Macandal whispered. I didn't expect the occasion would ever arise, Hanno said, not quite firmly. I arranged it as a provision in case of emergency, best kept secret till then. Jesus Christ, Aliat yelled. This is the emergency. You're making it yourself. Yes, Wanderer said. Sweat studded his skin. We didn't bargain for a dictator, and we're not going to knuckle under to any. We can't. He looked upward as if to find another face in the air. Pythias, it's become 7 against 1. That is not a consideration, the ship answered. It never was. At sea or anywhere men voyaged, Hanno said. It couldn't be if they were to make shore alive. What if the captain is incapacitated, Wanderer called. Insane. Did the ship take a few extra microseconds to scan its biopsychological database and draw its conclusion? Derangement is impossible for any of you without the severest trauma, it declared. That has not occurred. Dushan snarled. He started around the table. It can. A dead captain doesn't give orders. Svoboda moved to block him. Now you're the crazy one, she groaned. He sought to push her aside. She resisted. Help me. A fight. No, we can't. Wanderer joined her. They gripped Dushan by the arms. He halted. The wind sobbed in and out of him. See what you nearly caused, Hanno? Macandal spoke softly, though tears coursed down her cheeks. Your command would destroy us. You can't issue it. Can and will. The Phoenician stepped to the doorway, turned back toward them, stood alert but unmoving. His tone mildened. Once the decision's made, you won't go to pieces. I know you too well to believe you would, nor will you try violence against me. You realize you can't spare 1/8 of our strength, 1/4 of the forefathers to come, and I am the one of us who's held command, not simply leadership, but command, in ships and wars, trades and ventures beyond what was known over and over for thousands of years. Without me, your survival on Phaeacia or anywhere else is more than doubtful. Gentler still, oh, I'm no Superman. All of you have your own special gifts, and we need them all. I'm as open as ever to your thoughts, advice, yes, your wishes. But someone has to take the final responsibility. Someone always had to. The captain. We've another 12 years ahead of us, with God knows what at the end. Don't make them any harder on yourselves than they must be. He left. The 7 stood mute, half stupefied. At last Wanderer released Dushan, as Svoboda did, and said dully, He's right about that. We have no choice. The course change process will commence in an hour, Pythias announced. In order to conserve fuel and minimize the undesired vector, it begins at that time with going free. Please make ready for a waitless period of approximately 6 hours.
That is it,
Aliat choked. Hanno returned. They knew he had sought the control room partly to look at its displays, as if that mattered, but mainly as a sign unto them. We'd better get busy, he said. Here, I have print-out copies of a checklist. Done is done. We're on our way. He half-smiled. Not everybody hates this. Perhaps not, Svoboda replied. Sobaka, you dog. You total son of a bitch. She took Wanderer by the hand. 24. And Christ appeared before Aliat where she knelt. His radiance was not what she had imagined, brilliant as desert noonday. It filled the darkened hollowness of the church with a blue dusk and the last sunset gold. Almost she thought she heard bells from a caravan returning home. Warmth glowed into the stones beneath and around her. Nor was his visage gaunt and stern. In the west, she had heard, They showed him like this, a man who had tramped roads, shared wine and honeycomb, taken small children onto his lap. He smiled when he bent over her, and with his white sleeve dried the tears off her face. Straightening again, he said, "Oh, tenderly, because you have kept your vigil, though the smoke of hell blew about you, I have heard the prayer you dared not utter. For a time and a time, that which was lost shall be restored to you, and the latter end blessed more than the beginning." He lifted both scarred hands on high. "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted." He was gone. Young Barikai sprang down from the bima and raised her into his arms. "Beloved," he jubilated before she stopped his mouth with hers. Together they went out. Tadmor slumbered beneath a full moon, which frosted spires and dappled paving stones. A horse waited. Mane and tail were streams of moon silver. Barikai swung into the saddle. He reached down. She answered his clasp by soaring up to settle against him. Briefly, hoofs rang, then the horse leaped aloft and galloped the ways of air. Wind lulled, stars gleamed soft, everywhere around, in violet heaven. Aliat's loosened hair blew backward to make a tent for her and Barikai. She was drunk with the odor of him, the strength that held her, the seeking lips. "Where are we bound?" she asked. "Home," his laugh pealed, "but not at once." They hastened onward, around the curve of the world into morning. His castle gleamed on its mountaintop. The horse came to rest in a courtyard of mosaics and flowers where a fountain danced. Aliat gave them scant heed. Later she noticed that she had been unaware whether the servants who met their lord and lady had bodies. They did provide feast, music, spectacle, when such was wanted. Otherwise Aliat and Barikai kept to themselves, tireless until they fell embraced into a half-sleep, from which they roused joyous. That happiness grew calmer, love lingered more and more, so that at last it was a new bliss when he said, "Now let us go home." Their horse brought them there at dawn. The household was just coming awake, and nobody saw the arrival. Indeed, it was as if nothing had happened, and they had never been away. Manu received her hug with some surprise, then much boyish dignity. Little Hairan took it for granted. She savored ordinariness for the rest of the day and evening, minute by minute, each presence and place, task and talk, question and decision, everything that she owned and that owned her. When the final lamp guided her and Barikai to bed, she was ready for his words, "I think best you sleep, truly sleep, this night and beyond." "Hold me until I do," she asked of him. He did, with kisses. "Come not back too soon," he said once against her cheek. "That would be unwise." "I know." She drifted from him. Opening her eyes after a time outside of time, she found she was crying. Maybe this had been a bad idea. Maybe she should not go back ever. "Come on, old girl," she thought. "Stop this. You promised Corinne you'd help her with that tapestry she wants to make." Uncoupling, she left the booth where she had lain, but stood for a space more in the dream chamber, busy. Good habit, carrying a makeup kit and a purse. Sessions here did sometimes touch pretty near the bone. Well, she learned long ago how to cover the traces. Svoboda was passing by in the corridor. "Hello," said Aliat. She was about to move on when the other woman plucked her sleeve. "A moment, if you please," Svoboda requested. Sure. Aliat glanced away. Svoboda didn't take the hint. "Don't resent this. I must say it. You should go in there less often." Anger quivered. "Everybody else says it. Why not you? I know what I'm doing." "Well, I can't prescribe for you, but you're afraid I'm curling up in a ball and someday I won't be able to uncurl." Aliat inhaled. Suddenly she felt like speaking. "Listen, dear, you've been in situations in the past where you had to go away from yourself." Svoboda paled a bit. "Yes. I have a lot more than you. I know them pretty thoroughly, believe me. The dream box is a better escape than booze or dope or... Aliotta grinned, closing my eyes and thinking of England. But this isn't that kind of thing. No, not exactly. Still, listen. What happened today was that I got so furious that if I couldn't go conjure a private world, I'd have had to scream and smash things and generally throw a fit. What would that have done for crew morale? What was the matter? Hanno, what else? We met by chance, and he buttonholed me, and, oh, you can imagine, he repeated the same tired noises you just did about me and the dream box. He tried to say very roundabout. Never mind. Svoboda bared a brief smile. Let me guess. He implied you are a menace to relationships aboard ship. Yeah, he'd like to pair off with me. Of course he would. Hasn't gotten laid for months now, has he? I suggested what he could do instead and walked off. But I was volcano angry. You were overreacting, you of all people. Stress, I suppose. Faintly surprised at how rage and loss alike had eased within her, Aliotta said, Look, I'm not addicted to dreams. Really, I'm not. Everybody uses them once in a while. Why don't you share with me some time? I'd like that. An interactive dream has more possibilities than letting the computer put into your head what it thinks you've demanded. Svoboda nodded. True, but... She stopped. But you're afraid I might learn things about you you'd rather I didn't. That's it, right? Aliotta shrugged. I'm not offended. Only don't preach at me, okay? Why did you resent Hanno's attempt? Svoboda asked quickly. It was quite natural. You need not have cursed him for it. After what he's done to us? Counterattack. Do you still have a soft spot for him? Svoboda looked elsewhere. I shouldn't, I know. On se veut. What? Nothing, nothing. A stray memory. About him. Svoboda met the challenge. Probably, Aliotta thought. She wants to be friendly toward me. Feels she has to. Yes, of no importance. Some lines we saw once. It was the late 20th century, a few years after we seven had gone undercover, while Patulcius was still keeping his own camouflage. Hanno and I were traveling about incognito in France. We stayed one night at an old inn. Yes, old already then. And in the guest book we found what somebody had written long before. I was reminded now, that's all. What was it? Aliotta asked. Again Svoboda looked past her, the wry words whispered forth as if of themselves. On se veut, on s'en lasse, on s'en lasse, on s'en veut. Before Aliotta could respond, she nodded at Hugh and hurried on down the corridor. 23. Once more Yukiko was redecorating her room. Until she finished, it would be an uninhabitable clutter. Thus she spent most of her private hours in Dushan's, as well as sleeping there. In due course, they would share hers while she worked on his. It was her proposal. He had assented without seeming to care. The brushstroke landscape and calligraphy she earlier put on his walls had over the years been seen until they were all but invisible. However, she had a feeling that he would never especially have noticed their disappearance. Entering, she found him cross-legged on the bed, left hand supporting a picture screen, right hand busy with the light pencil. He drew something, considered it, made an alteration, studied it further. His big body seemed relaxed, and the features bore no mark of a scowl. "Why, what are you doing?" she asked. He glanced up. I have an idea, he said, almost eagerly. It isn't clear to me yet, but sketching helps me think. She went around behind him and leaned over to see. His drawings were always delicate, a contrast to much of his work in stone or wood. This showed a man in traditional peasant garb holding a spade. On a large rock beside him squatted a monkey, while a tiger stood below. Through the foreground flowed a stream wherein swam a carp. "So you are finally going to try pictures?" she guessed. He shook his head. No, no. You are far better at them than I will ever be. These are just thoughts about figures I mean to sculpture. He gazed up at her. I think pictures may not help us much when we get to Tritus. Even on Earth, in old days, you remember how differently people in different times and countries would draw the same things. To the alloy, any style of line, shade, color we might use may not make sense. Photographs may not. But a three-dimensional shape, no ghost in a computer, a solid thing they can handle, that should speak to them. Tritus, alloy, he pronounced the names awkwardly, but one needed better words than Star 3 and others, and when Ptolemaeus suggested these, the crew soon went along. Greek still bore its aura of science, learning, civilization. To three of those in the ship it had been common speech for centuries. Mitroaster for Mother Star had, though, been voted down, and Pegasi was back in use. After all, nobody could say whether the alloy or Tritus had come from there, or even whether it was son to a sentient race. Hanno sat mute through the discussion, and merely nodded his acceptance. He spoke little these days, and others no more to him than was necessary. "Yes, an excellent thought," Yukiko said. "What do you mean to show?" "I am groping my way toward that," Dushan replied. "Your ideas will be welcome. Here, I think, might be a group, more creatures than these, arranged according to our degrees of kinship with the animals. That may lead the alloy to show us something about their evolution, which ought to tell us things about them." "Excellent!" Yukiko trilled laughter. "But how can you now keep up your pretense of being a simple-minded farmer and blacksmith?" She bent low, hugged him, laid her cheek on his. "This makes me so happy. You were sullen and silent, and I truly feared you were going back to that miserable, beastly way of living I found you in. How long ago?" He stiffened. Harshness came into his voice. "Why not? What else had our dear captain left us before this came to me out of the dark? It will help fill a little of the emptiness ahead." She let go and slipped about to sit down on the bed in front of him. "I wish you could be less bitter toward Hanno," she said, troubled. "You and the rest of them." "Have we no reason to?" "Oh, he was high-handed, true. But has he not been punished enough for that? How dare we take for granted that what he's done is not for the best? It may prove to be what saves us." "Easy for you. You want to seek the alloy." "But I don't want this hateful division between us. I dare not give him a friendly word myself. I'm afraid of making matters worse. It makes me wish we'd never received the message. Can't you see, dear, he is like a righteous emperor of ancient times, taking on himself the heavy burden of leadership?" Again Dushan shook his head, but violently. "Nonsense! You are drawn to him. Don't deny—" Her tone went calm. "To his spirit, yes. It isn't like mine, but it also seeks. And to his person, no doubt, but I've honestly not dwelt on that in my mind." She closed hands upon his knee. "You are the one I am with." It mildened him to a degree. Sternness remained. "Well, stop imagining he's some kind of saint or sage. He's a scheming, knavish old sailor who naturally wants to sail. This is his selfishness. He happens to have the power to force it on us." He slapped the screen down onto the blanket as if striking with a weapon. "I am only trying to help us outlive the evil." She leaned close. Her smile trembled. "That is enough to make me love you." 24. Yet another Christmas drew nigh in the ship's chronology. It was meaningless to ask whether it did on Earth just then, doubly meaningless, given the physics here and the forgottenness yonder. Hanno came upon Svoboda hanging ornaments in the common room. Evergreen boughs from the nanoprocessors were fresh and fragrant, bejeweled with berries of holly. They seemed as forlorn as the Danish carols from the speakers. She saw him and tautened. He halted, not too close to her. "Hello," he proffered. "How do you do?" she said. He smiled. Her face stayed locked. "What sort of party are you planning this year?" he asked. She shrugged. "No motif." "Oh, I'll keep out of the way, never fear." Quickly. "But we can't go on much longer like this. We'll lose skills, including the skills of teamwork. We must start having simulations and practicing in them again." "As the captain directs. I suppose, though, you're aware that Wanderer and I, at least, are doing so. We'll bring others in presently." Hanno made himself meet the blue gaze, and made it stay upon his. "Yes, naturally, I know. Good. For you two, above all. A phantom wilderness is better than none, right?" Svoboda bit her lip. "We could have had the real thing." "You will, after we're through at Tritus. You wanted to go there first yourself. Why don't you look forward to it? You know why. Because to my comrades..." She closed a fist and clipped. "Not that we can't cope. I outlived many bad husbands, dreary decades, tyrants, wars, everything men could wreak. I will outlive this, too. We will." "Myself among you," he said, and continued on his way. It was no particular goal. He often prowled, mostly at ship night, or through sections where nobody else had occasion to be. An immortal body needed little exercise to keep fit, but he worked regularly at his capabilities and developed new ones. He screened books and shows, listened to music, played with problems on the computers. Frequently, as in the past, when stimuli palled and thought flagged, he disengaged his mind and let hours or days flow by, scarcely registering on him. That, however, was in its way as seductive, easily overdone as the dream chamber which he shunned. He could but hope that his crew rationed themselves on illusions. Today impulse returned him to his stateroom. He sealed himself in, not that anyone would come calling, and settled down before his terminal. "Activate." The command fell so flat across silence that he chopped it short. For a while he stared at the ceiling. His fingers drummed the desktop. "Historical persons," he said. "Whom do you wish?" inquired the instrumentality. Hanno's mouth writhed upward. "You mean, what do I wish?" "What three-dimensional, full-color, changeably expressive, freely moving and speaking wraith?" "Siddhartha, Socrates, Hillel, Christ, Aeschylus, Virgil, Dufou, Ferdowsi, Shakespeare, Goethe, Mark Twain, Lucretius, Avicenna, Maimonides, Descartes, Pascal, Hume, Pericles, Alfred, Jefferson, Hatshepsut, Sappho, Murasaki, Rabia, Margarita I, Jeanne d'Arc, Elizabeth I, Sacagawea, Jane Austen, Florence Nightingale, Marie Curie, Isaac Dinesen. Yes, or if you liked, the great monsters and she-devils. Have your machine take everything, history, archaeology, psychology, new of a person, and that person's world, down to the last least scrap, with probabilities assigned to each uncertainty and conjecture. Let it model, with subtle and powerful abstract manipulations, the individual whom this matrix could have produced, and who would have changed it in precisely those ways that were known. Make it write the program, activate, and meet that human creature. The image of the body was a mere construct, as easily generated as any other. But while the program ran, the mind existed, sensed, thought, reacted, conscious of what it was, but seldom troubled thereby, usually enthusiastic, interested, anxious to discourse. "Old myths and nightmares have become real," Svoboda said once, "while old reality slips away from us. On earth they now raise the dead, but are themselves only half alive." "That isn't strictly true, either side of it," Hanno had replied. "Take my advice from experience, and don't call up anybody you ever actually knew. They're never quite right. Often they're grotesquely wrong." Unless memory failed after centuries, or unless the past was as uncertain, as flickeringly quantum variable, as everything else in the universe of physics. Seated alone, Hanno winced, partly at recollection of a time when he sought advice from the electronic revenant of Cardinal Richelieu, partly at recalling how he and Svoboda had been together then. "I don't want any single companion," he said to the machine, "nor a synthetic personality. Give me several ancient explorers. A meeting, a council. Can you do that?" "Certainly. It is a non-standard interaction, requiring some creative preparation. 1 minute, please." 60 billion nanoseconds. The first of the faces looking out was strong and serene. "I don't quite know what to say," Hanno began hesitantly, well-nigh timidly. "You've been told about the situation here. Well, what do I need? What do you think I should do?" "You should have taken more thought for your folk," answered Fritjof Nansen. The computer translated between them. "But I understand it is too late to change course again. Be patient." "Endure," said Ernest Shackleton. Ice gleamed on his beard. "Never surrender." "Think of the others," Nansen urged. "Yes, you lead, and so you must. But think about how it feels to them." "Share your vision," said Mark Orlstein. "I died gladly because it was where I had wanted to go for 60 years. Help them want." "Ha! Why are they sniveling?" roared Peter Freuchen. "My God, what an adventure! Bring me back to see when you get there, lad." "Give me your guidance," Hanno entreated. "I've discovered I'm no Boethius to console myself with philosophy. Maybe I have made a terrible mistake. Lend me your strength." "You'll only find strength in yourself, sir," declared Henry Stanley, "not in spooks like us. But you aren't. You're made out of what was real. If something of what we did and were survives to this day, we should be proud, my friends," said Nansen. "Come, let us put it back into service. Let us try to find good counsel." Willem Barents shivered. "For so strange a voyage, most likely to a lonely death? Commend your soul to God, Hanno. There is nothing else." "No, we owe them more than that," said Nansen. "They are human. As long as men and women fare outward, they will be human." 25. Macandal sent her glance slowly from one to the next of the six who sat around the table in the saloon with her. "I suppose you've guessed why I've asked you to come," she said at length. Most of them stayed unstirring. Svoboda grimaced. Wanderer beside her laid a hand on her thigh. Macandal took a bottle and poured into a glass. The claret gurgled dusky rose. Its pungency sweetened the air. She passed the bottle on. Glasses had been set out for everyone. "Let's have a drink first," she proposed. Patulcius attempted a jest. "Are you taking a leaf from the early Persians? Remember, when they had an important decision to make, they discussed it once while sober and once while drunk." "Not the worst idea ever," Macandal said. "Better than these modern drugs and neurostims." "If only because wine has tradition behind it," Yukiko murmured. "It means it is more than its mere self." "How much tradition is left in the world?" Aliat asked bitterly. "We carry it," Wanderer said. "We are it." The bottle circulated. Macandal raised her goblet. "To the voyage," she toasted. After a moment, "Yes, drink, all of you. What this meeting is about is restoring something good." "If it has not been wholly destroyed," Dushan grated, but he joined the rest in the small, pregnant ceremony. "Okay," Macandal said. "Now listen. Each of you knows I've been after him or her, arguing, wheedling, scolding, trying to wear down those walls of anger you've built around yourselves. Maybe some haven't noticed it was in fact each of you. Tonight's when we bring it out in the open." Svoboda spoke stiffly. "What is there to talk about? Reconciliation with Hanno? We have no breach. Nobody has dreamed of mutiny. It's impossible. A change of course back to Phaeacia is impossible, too. We haven't the antimatter. We're making the best of things. Honey, you know damn well we are not. Steel-toned beneath Macandal's mildness. Cold courtesy and mechanical obedience won't get us through whatever waits ahead. We need our fellowship back. So you've told me, us, over and over. Wanderer's voice was raw. You're right, of course. But we didn't break it. He did. Macandal regarded him for a quiet spell. You're really hurting, aren't you? He was my best friend, Wanderer said from behind his mask. He still is, Johnny. It's you who shut him out. Well, he... Speech trailed off. Yukiko nodded. He has made approaches to you also, then, she deduced. To everyone, I'm sure. Tactful, admitting he could be wrong. He has not groveled, Dushan conceded, but he has put down his pride. Not insisting we are the ones mistaken, Svoboda added, as if unwillingly. We may be, you know, Yukiko argued. The choice had to be made, and only he could make it. At first you wanted this way yourself. Are you certain it was not just your own pride that turned you against him? Why did you change your mind and join us? For your sakes. Dushan sighed. Yukiko has worked on me, he told the others. And Hanno, well, I have not forgotten what he did for us two in the past. Ah, he has begun to make himself clear to you, Patulcius observed. Me too, me too. I still don't agree with him. But the worst rancor has bled off. Who advised him how to speak with us? He's had a long time alone for thinking, Macandal said. Aliat shuddered. Too long. It's been too long. Svoboda's words fell sharp. I don't see how we can ever again be wholehearted about him. But you are right, Corinne. We must rebuild as much faith as we can. Heads nodded. It was no climax. It was the recognition of something foreseen, so slow and grudging in its growth that the completion of it came as a kind of surprise. Macandal need merely say, Grand. Oh, grand. Let's drink to that, and then relax and talk about old times. Tomorrow I'll cook a feast, and we'll throw a party and invite him and get drunk with him. Her laugh rang, in the finest Persian style. Hours afterward, when she and Patulcius were in her room making ready for bed, he said, That was superbly handled, my dear. You should have gone into politics. I did once, sort of, you recall, she answered with a slight smile. Hanno put you up to this from the beginning, didn't he? You're pretty shrewd yourself, Gnaeus. And you coached him in how to behave, carefully, patiently, month after month, with each of us. Well, I made suggestions, and he had help from the ship. Advice. He never told me much about that. I think it was an experience too close to his heart. She paused. He's always guarded his heart, too carefully. I guess because of the losses he suffered in all those thousands of years. But he's no fool either, where it comes to dealing with people. Patulcius looked at her a while. She had slipped off her gown and stood dark, supple before him. Her face against the wall, which was muraled with lilies, made him remember Egypt. You're a great woman, he said low. You're not a bad guy. Great for accepting me, he slogged on. I know it pained you when Wanderer went to Svoboda. I think it still pains you. It's good for them. Maybe not ideal, but good. And we do need stable relationships. Macandal flung her head back and laughed afresh. Hey, listen to me, talking like a 20th-century social worker. She swung her hips. Come on over here, big boy. 26. Clouds massed huge, blue-black over the high place. Lightning flared, thunder crashed. The fire before the altar leaped and cast sparks like stars down the wind. The acolytes led the sacrifice to the waiting priest. His knife glimmered. In the grove below, worshippers howled. Afar, the sea ran white, and monsters rose from its depths. No, Aliat wailed. Stop! That's a child! It is a beast, a lamb, Wanderer called back against the noise, but he kept his glance elsewhere. It is both, Hanno said to them. Be still. Knife flashed, limbs threshed, blood spurted and flowed dark over stone. The priest cast the body into the flames. Flesh sizzled on coals, fell away from bones, went up in fat smoke. Through the storm, terrible in their splendor, came the gods. Pillar tall, bull broad, beard spilling down over the lion skin that clad him, eyes capturing the fire gleam, Melkart snuffed deep. He licked his lips. It is done. It is well. It is life, he boomed. Wind tossed the hair of Ashtoreth. Rain jeweled it. Lightning light sheened on breasts and belly. Her own nostrils drank. She clasped his gigantic organ as if it were a staff and raised her left hand into heaven. Bring forth the resurrected, she cried. Baal Adon leaned heavily on Adot, his beloved, his mourner, his avenger. He stumbled, still half-blind after the murk of the underworld. He trembled, still half-frozen from the grave. She guided him to the smoke of the offering. She took the bowl filled with its blood and gave him to drink. Warmth returned, beauty, wakefulness. He saw, he heard, how men and women coupled in the grove and across the land in honor of his arising, and he turned to his consort. More gods crowded about, Kushor out of the waves, Dagon out of the ploughlands, a lion out of the springs and underground waters, Reshef out of the storm, and more clouds began to part. Distantly gleamed the twin pillars and pure lake before the home of El. A sunbeam smote the eight who stood on the tophet near the beetle, invisible to priest and acolytes. The gods stared and stiffened. Melkart raised his club that had smitten the sea, primordial chaos, in the dawn of the world. "Who dares betread the Holy of Holies?" he bellowed. Hanno trod forward. "Dread ones," he said calmly, with respect but not abasing himself, looking straight into those eyes. "We are eight from afar in space, time, and strangeness. We too command the powers of heaven, earth, and hell. But fain would we guest you a while, and learn the wonders of your reigning. Behold, we bear gifts." He signaled, and there appeared a treasure of golden ware, gems, precious woods, incense. Melkart lowered his weapon and stared with a greed that awoke also in the features of Ashtoreth, but her regard was on the men. 27. One by one they disengaged. That was a simple matter of removing induction helmets and feedback suits. The web of union between them and the guiding, creating computer had already vanished. The pseudo-experience was at an end. Nonetheless, after they had emerged from their booths into the commonplaceness of the dream chamber, it took them silent minutes to return altogether to themselves. Meanwhile, they stood side by side, hand in hand, groping for comfort. Eventually, Patulcius mumbled, "I thought I knew something about the ancient Near East, but that was the most damnable—" "Horror and wonder," Makandal said unevenly. "Lust and love. Death and life. Was it really like that, Hanno?" "I can't be sure," the captain answered. "The historical Tyre we visited seemed about right to me." In a full sensory hallucination, where the computer drew on his memories and then let the seekers act and be acted on as they would have in a material world. "Hard to tell after so long. Besides, you know, I tried to put it behind me. Try to grow away from what was bad in it. This, though, the Phoenician conceptual universe. No, I don't believe I ever thought in just that way, even when I was young and supposed I was mortal." "No matter authenticity," Yukiko said. "We want practice in dealing with aliens, and this was amply alien." "Too much," Dushan's burly frame shivered. "Come, dear, I want a time gentle and human, don't you?" She accompanied him out. "What society shall we draw on next?" asked Svoboda. Her attention sought Wanderer. "Those you knew must have been at least as foreign to the rest of us."
"No doubt," he replied rather grimly. "In due course, yes, we will. But first a setting more rational. China, Russia?"
"We have plenty of time," Petulchia said. "Better we digest this before we think about anything else.
Kyrie eleison, to have witnessed the gods at work."
He tugged at Makandal.
"I'm exhausted. A stiff drink, a long sleep, and several days' idleness."
"Right." Her smile was fainter than usual. They left. Wanderer and Svoboda seemed aroused. Their gazes came aglow. She reddened. His breast rose and fell. They also departed. Hanno took care not to watch. Aliat had clasped his hand. Now she let go. He spoke dully.
"Well, how was it for you?
Terror and ecstasy and..."
"A kind of homecoming," she said, barely audible.
He nodded.
"Yes, even though you started life as a Christian, it wouldn't be totally foreign to you. In fact, I suspect the program used some memories of yours as input where mine weren't sufficient."
"Weird enough, though." He stared beyond her.
"A dream within a dream," he murmured, as if to himself.
"What do you mean?"
Svoboda would understand. "Once she and I imagined what kind of future it might be where we dared reveal what we were."
Hanno shook himself.
"Never mind. Good night."
She caught his arm. "No, wait." He stopped, lifted his brows, stood alert in a fashion weary and wary. Aliat grasped his hand again.
"Take me along," she said.
"Eh?
You're too lonely."
"And I am.
Let's come back together. And stay."
Deliberately, he said,
"Are you tired of subsisting on Svoboda's and Corinne's leavings?"
For a moment she lost color. She released him. Then she reddened and admitted, "Yes.
You and me, we're neither of us the other's first pick, are we? And you've never forgiven me for Constantinople. Not really." "Why," he said, taken aback, "I've told you I have. Over and over I've told you. I hoped my actions proved..."
"Well, just don't let it make any difference that counts.
What's the point of our living all these centuries if we haven't grown up even a little?
Hanno, I'm offering you what nobody else in this ship will, yet. Maybe they never will. But we are getting back something of what we had. Between us, you and I could help that healing along."
She tossed her head. "If you aren't game to try, to give in your turn, okay. Good night into hell with you."
"No."
He seized her by the waist.
"Aliat, of course, I'm overwhelmed."
"You are nothing of the sort, you calculating old scoundrel, and well I know it." She came to him. The embrace went on. Finally, flushed, disheveled, she said against his shoulder,
"Sure, I'm a rogue myself. Always will be, I guess. But I learned more about you than I'd known, Hanno. It wasn't a dream while we were there. It was as real to us as... no, more real than these damned crowding walls. You stood up to the gods, outsmarted them, made them take us in, like nobody else alive could have. You are the skipper."
She raised her face. Tears were on it, but a grin flashed malapert.
"They didn't wear me out. That's your job. And if we can't entirely trust each other, if the thing between us won't quite die away, why, doesn't that add a pinch of spice?"
28. Throughout the final months, as Pythias backed ever more slowly down to destination, the universe again appeared familiar. Strange that a night crowded with unwinking brilliant stars, girded by the frost road of the galaxy, where nebulae querned forth new suns and worlds, while energies raged monstrous around those that had died, and light that came from neighbor fire wheels had left them before humanity was, should feel homelike. Waxing ahead, Tritus had barely more than half the brightness of Sol, a yellow hue that stirred memories of autumns on Earth. Yet it, too, was a hearth. Instruments peered across narrowing distance. 10 planets orbited, 5 of them gas giants. The second inmost swung at somewhat less than 1 astronomical unit's radius. It possessed a satellite whose eccentric path indicated the primary mass was slightly over 2 1/3 the terrestrial. Nevertheless, that globe, though warmer on the average, was at reasonable temperatures, and its atmospheric spectrum revealed chemical disequilibria such as must be due to life. Week by week, then day by day, excitement burned higher within the ship. There was no quenching it, and presently even Dushan and Patulcius stopped trying. They were committed. Magnificent things might wait, and here was, for a while at least, an end of wayfaring. The peace with Hanno that each had made on his or her own terms did not strengthen into the former fellowship. If anything, it thinned, stretched by a new guardedness. What might he want next, and how might someone else react? He had promised that eventually they would go on to Phaeacia. But when would that be? Would it ever? Could he then betray it? Nobody made accusations, or indeed brooded much on the matter. Conversation was generally free and easy, if not intimate, and he joined again in some recreations. But no more in shared dreams, once their training purpose had been served. He remained half the outsider, in whom none but Aliat confided, and she little except for her body. He did not attempt to change their attitudes. He knew better. And he knew as well how to pass lifetime after mortal lifetime among strangers to his spirit. Tritus grew in sight. Pythias cast signals ahead, radio, laser, neutrino. Surely the alloy had detected the ship from afar, roiling the dust and gas of space, breaking with a flame out of the furnace engine. Receivers caught no flicker of response. "Have they gone?" Lacandal fretted. "Have we come this whole way for nothing?" "We're still many light hours off," Wanderer reminded her. The hunter's patience was upon him. "Can't talk very readily, not at all by electromagnetic waves, while our drive blazes in front of us, and I would scan a newcomer first before leaving my cover." She shook her head, half angrily. "Forget the Stone Age, John. Anything like war or piracy between the stars isn't just obscene, it's absurd." "Can you be absolutely certain? Besides, we could be dangerous to them, or they to us, in ways neither party has managed to imagine." Tritus brightened, without magnification, simply with the light stopped down. Eyes beheld the disk, spots upon it, flares leaping aloft. Offside stood a bluish-white steady spark that was the second planet. Now spectroscopy gave details of land and water surfaces, air mostly nitrogen and oxygen. The travelers changed course to intercept. The name they bestowed was Xenogea. The hour came when Pythias called, "Attention, attention, coded signals detected." The 8 crowded into the command room. That wasn't physically necessary. They could quite well have perceived and partaken from their separate quarters. It was merely impossible for them not to be side by side, breath mingling with breath. The message employed the same basic system as had the robots. 12 years ago, ship's time, 3 1/2 cosmic centuries, minus relativistic adjustments no longer required. It arrived by UHF radio, from somewhat aft, to avoid ionization that was no longer enormously strong but could still interfere. "The source is a comparatively small object about 1,000,000 kilometers distant," Pythias reported. "It has presumably lain in orbit until we came this near. At present it is accelerating to match our vectors. Radiation is weak, indicating high efficiency." "A boat?" Hanno wondered. "Has it a mothership?" Pythias assembled the images transmitted. They sprang into vivid existence. First appeared a starscape, then an unmistakable Tritus. You could compare what was in a view screen. Then a dizzying zoom in on forms, colors, a thing that swept lopsidedly around a larger.
That must be Xenogia, Patulcius said into a thick silence. It must be where they stay.
I think they are preparing us for what comes next, Yukiko said. The representation vanished. A new form was there. They could not at once properly see it. The contours, the mathematical dimensionality were too exotic, too far beyond any expectation. Thus had it been for Svoboda and Wanderer when first they glimpsed high mountains, snow clouds, heaven gone wrinkled, or what?
More art? Dushan puzzled. They do not make pictures like any that humans ever did. I think they do not sense like us.
No, Hanno said. This is likelier a straightforward hologram. The hair stood up on his arms.
Maybe they don't know how we see either, but the reality is the same for all of us, I hope.
The image moved, a slow and careful pirouette, revealing it from every angle. It reached out of the scene and brought back a lump of something soft, which it proceeded to mold into a series of geometrical solids, sphere, cube, cone, pyramid, interlinked rings.
"It's telling us it's intelligent," Aliat whispered.
Blindly she crossed herself. Vision began to understand. If the image was life-size, the original stood about 140 centimeters tall. Central was a stalk, a green that glittered and shimmered, supported on two thin limbs that were flexible or multiply jointed, ending in several bifurcated digits. At the top sprouted two similar arms. These forked, subdivided, sub-subdivided, dendritically, till the watchers were unable to count the last spidery delicate fingers. From the side spread a pair of wings, membranes, to a span that equaled the height. They looked as if made of nacre and diamond dust, but rippled like silk. After a long time, Dushan muttered, "If this is what they are, how shall we ever know them?"
"The way we knew the spirits, maybe," Wanderer answered as softly. "I remember Kachina dances."
"For God's sake," Svoboda cried, "what are we waiting for? Let's show them us."
Hanno nodded. "Of course."
The spacecraft moved on together toward the living world. 29. Sopithius came to harbor, took orbit about Xenogia. That required special care. There were other bodies to give a wide berth. Foremost was the moon. Scarred and ashen as Earth's, it had only a tenth the mass, but its path brought it inward to about a third the lunar distance from its primary, then out again to three-fifths. Some cosmic accident must have caused that, more recent than the impacts that formed the planet. A number of artificial satellites wheeled in their own courses. None resembled any in the solar system. Boats, as Hanno dubbed them, came and went. His folk were unsure how many, for no two seemed alike. Only slowly did they realize that form changed according to mission, and force fields had more to do with it than crystal or fiber. The Alasan mothership, another human phrasing, orbited well beyond the moon. It appeared to be a fixed shape, a cylindroid almost 10 kilometers in length and 2 in diameter, majestically rotating on its long axis, mother of pearl iridescent. Aft was a complex of slender curved members which might be the drive generator. It put Hanno in mind of interwoven vine patterns he had seen on Nordic runestones and in Irish gospels. Forward, the hull flared and then came to a point, making Patulcius and Svoboda recall a minaret or a church spire. Yukiko wondered about its age. 1,000,000 years did not seem unthinkable. "They probably live aboard," Wanderer opined. "What weight does that spin provide?" 67% of standard terrestrial gravity, the ship responded.
Yeah, they look as if they come from that kind of environment. It means, let's see, you told us Xenogean pull equals 1.4 times Earth's. So for them...
No, no, let me show off, Wanderer laughed.
It's twice what they're used to.
Can they take it?
We could if we had to, Makandal said. But the alloy do seem fragile.
She hesitated. Like crystal, or a bare tree iced over on a clear winter day. They are quite beautiful once you learn how to look at them.
I think we shall have to, declared Dushan harshly. I mean, bear an added 40 kilos on each 100.
Their gazes followed his to that view screen in the common room which held an image of Xenogea. They were passing the dayside, the planet nearly full. It was brighter than Earth, for it was more clouded. Whiteness swirled and billowed, thinly marbled with the blue of oceans, spotted with greenish-brown glimpses of land. Though the axis tilted a full 31 degrees, neither pole bore a cap. Snow gleamed rarely on the tallest mountains. Aliat shivered. The motion loosened her hold on a table edge and sent her slowly off through the air. Hanno caught her. She clung to his hand.
"Go down there," she asked. "Must we?"
"You know we can't stay healthy in weightlessness," he reminded her. "We can for longer than mortals born, and we've got medications that help. But finally our muscles and bones will shrink, too, and our immune systems fail."
"Yes, yes, yes. But yonder?"
"We need a minimum weight. This ship isn't big enough to spin for that by itself. Too much radial variation. Too much Coriolis force." She glared through tears. "I am not an idiot. I have not forgotten. Nor have I forgotten the robots can fix that."
"Yes, separate the payload and engine sections, hitch a long cable between, then spin them. The trouble is, that immobilizes Pythias till it's reassembled. I think you'll all agree we'd better hang on to its capabilities as well as the boats, at least till we know a lot more."
"Shall we shelter on the first planet?" Dushan asked. "A seared hell. The third isn't this large either, but a frozen barren waste, and likewise every outer moon or asteroid."
Svoboda looked still toward Xenogea.
"Here is life," she said. 40% additional weight won't harm us, given our innate hardiness. We will grow used to it."
"We grew used to heavier burdens in the past," Makandal observed quietly.
"But what I'm trying to say, if you'll let me," Aliat yelled, "is can't the alloy do something for us?"
By this time, considerable information exchange had taken place. Diagrams, interior views of vessels, whatever the non-humans chose to offer and the humans thought to. It included sounds. From the alloy, those were notes high and coldly sweet that might be speech, or might be music, or might be something incomprehensible. It seemed likely that they were going about establishing communication in systematic wise, but the naive newcomers had not yet fathomed the system. They dared hope that the first most basic message had gotten through on both sides and was mutually honest. "Our will is good. We want to be your friends." Hanno frowned. "Do you imagine they can control gravitation? What about that, Pythias?"
"They give no indication of any such technology," answered the ship, "and it is incompatible with known physics."
"Uh-huh. If it did exist. If they could do it, I expect they'd have so many other powers they wouldn't bother with the kind of stuff we've met."
Hanno rubbed his chin. "But they could build a spinnable orbital station to our specs. A nice little artificial environment for us to sit in and turn to lard the way we were doing here," exploded from Wanderer. "No, by God! Not when we've got a world to walk on."
Svoboda uttered a cheer. Dushan beamed. Patalkius nodded vigorously.
"Right," said Makandal after a moment. "That is, provided we can survive there," Yukiko pointed out. chemistry, biology. It may be lethal to us.
Or maybe not, Wanderer said. Let's get busy and find out.
The ship and its robots commenced that task. In the beginning, humans were hardly more than eager spectators. Instruments searched, sampled, analyzed. Computers pondered. Boats entered atmosphere. After several sorties had provided knowledge of surface conditions, they landed. The intelligent machines that debarked transmitted back their findings. Then, as the humans gained familiarity, they became increasingly a part of the team, first suggesting, later directing, and deciding. They were not scientific specialists, nor need they be. The ship had ample information and logic power, the robots abundant skills. The travelers were the embodied curiosity, desire, will of the whole. Hanno was barely peripheral. His concern was with the alloy. Likewise did Yukiko's become. He longed most for what they might tell him about themselves and their fairings among the stars. She thought of arts, philosophies, transcendence. Both had a gift for dealing with the foreign, an intuition that often overleaped jumbled, fragmentary data to reach a scheme that gave meaning. Thus had Newton, Planck, Einstein gone straight to insights that inexplicably proved to explain and predict. So had Darwin, De Vries, Oparin, and so perhaps had Gautama Buddha. When explorers on Earth encountered peoples totally foreign to them, Europeans in America, for instance, the parties soon groped their way to understanding each other's languages. Nothing like that happened at Tritus. Here the sundering was not of culture and history, nor of species, phylum, kingdom. Two entire evolutions stood confronted. The beings not only did not think alike, they could not. Compare just the human hand and its allosaur equivalent. The latter had less strength, although the grip was not negligible when all digits laid hold on something. It had vastly more sensitivity, especially in the fine outer branchlets, a lower threshold of perception, and a wider, better coordinated field of it. The hair-like ultimate ends clung by molecular ringing, and the organism felt how they did. Thus, the subjective world was tactily richer than ours by orders of magnitude. Was it optically poorer? Impossible to say, quite likely meaningless to ask. The Alasan wings were partly regulators of body temperature, partly excretors of vaporous waste, mainly networks of sensors. These included organs responsive to light, simpler than eyes, but in their numbers and diversity, perhaps capable of equal precision. Whether this was so or not depended on how the brain processed their input, and there did not seem to be any single structure corresponding to a brain. Enough! It would probably take Hanno and Yukiko years to learn the anatomy. It would certainly take them longer to interpret it. For the moment they understood, borrowing terrestrial concepts, grotesquely inappropriate. They were dealing not only with software unlike their own, but hardware. It was not to be expected that they would readily master its kind of language. Perhaps beyond some kind of rudiments, they never would. Presumably, the alloy had had earlier practice among aliens and had developed various paradigms. The pair found themselves acquiring facility as they worked, not simply struggling to comprehend, but making contributions to the effort. More and more, intent clarified. A primitive code took shape. Material contacts began, cautious to start with, bolder as confidence grew. The fear was not of violence, or, for that matter, under these circumstances, said Hanno, grinning, chicanery. It was of surprises that might lurk in a universe where life seemed to be incidental and intelligence accidental. What condition taken for granted by one race might harm the other? What innocuous or necessary microbes might elsewhere brew death? Robots met in space. They traded samples that they took to shielded laboratories for study. At any rate, it happened aboard Pythias. Nanotech and biotech gave quick responses. While the chemistries were similar, even to most amino acids, the deviations were such as to bar cross-infection. Yes, the specimens sent by the alloy had things in them that probably corresponded somewhat to viruses, but the fundamental life stuff resembled DNA no more than a file does a saw. After repeated experiments of that general sort, robots paid visits to ships. The Alasan machines were graceful, multi-tentacular, a pleasure to watch swooping about. Within the Alasan vessel, the air was thin, dry, but humanly breathable. Temperatures went through cycles, as they did in Pythias, the range being from cool to chilly. Light was tinged like that from Tritus, less bright than outside, but adequate. Centrifugal weight was as predicted, 2/3 of a G, also sufficient. As for what else the great hull bore, work on Xenogea proceeded more straightforwardly. Planetology was a mature discipline, a set of techniques, formulas, and computer models. This globe fitted the pattern. Meteorology and climatology were less exact. Some predictions could never be made with certainty, for chaos inhered in the equations. However, the overall picture soon emerged. A strong greenhouse effect overcompensated a high albedo. Other things being equal, every clime was hotter than at the same latitude on Earth. Of course, things seldom were equal. Thus the tropics had their pleasant islands as well as their steaming continental swamps or blistering deserts. Axial tilt and rotation rate, once around in slightly more than 21 hours, made for powerful cyclonic wind patterns, but the heavy atmosphere and warm polar regions moderated weather almost everywhere. Though conditions were unstable compared to the terrestrial, subject to swifter and often unforeseeable change, dangerous storms were no commoner than on Earth before control. In composition, the air was familiar. Higher humidity, rather more carbon dioxide, several percent less oxygen. For humans, the latter was more than made up by the sea-level pressure, twice their standard. It was air they could safely inhale, and uncorrupted. Life covered, filled, drenched the planet. Its chemistry was akin to the terrestrial and Alasan, with its own uniqueness. Given considerations of energy, followed by the scores of cases robots had reported to Earth, that was expected. As always, the astonishment sprang from the details, the infinite versatility of protein and inventiveness of nature. On the prosaic side, humans could eat most things, though probably few would taste very good. Some would be poisonous, and none would provide complete nutrition. Probably they would be safe from every predator, microbe, and virus. Mutation might eventually change that, but modern biomedicine should handily cope. For the survivors, with their peculiar immune and regenerative systems, the hazard would almost be non-existent. They could grow terrestrial crops if they chose, and then animals to feed on the grass and grain. This was not virgin Earth given back to them. It was not Phaeacia of their dreams. Yet here they could make a home. Here they would have neighbors. "And he's been so lonely," Macandal said to Patulcius. She and Hanno, no monkey business between them. Might be better if there were. It's just that they're both wrapped up in their research till it's as if nothing and nobody else quite exists for them. Aliats complained to me. I can't do much for her, but I've gotten an idea about Dushan. She singled out others and gave them the same thought privately, in words she deemed suited to each. Nobody objected. On the chosen evening, after she had done the poor best that could be done to produce a feast in weightlessness, she called for a vote, and Dushan received his surprise. A spaceboat descended, assisted by two robots, because initial problems with gravity were unavoidable after this long in orbit. He stepped forth, the first human being on Xenogea. He had left off his shoes. The soil lay warm and moist. Its odors enriched his breath. He wept. Shortly afterward, Hanno and Yukiko returned from the Alisan ship. The visit had been their first. The six aboard Pythias gathered around them in the common room. All floated watchful as pikes in a lake. A mural, enlarged from Falaise of Varengeville. Sea, sky, cliff, its shadow on the water, brush golden with sunlight, seemed more remote in time and space than Monet himself. "No, I cannot tell you what we saw," Yukiko said, almost like one who speaks in sleep. "We haven't the words, not even for the images they've sent here, but somehow that interior is alive." "Not just dead metal and electronic trickery," Hanno added. He was altogether awake, ablaze. "Oh, they've much to teach us, and I do believe we'll have news for them once we've found how to tell it. But it seems they can't come to us in person. We don't know why, what's wrong with our environment, but I think that if they were able to, they would." "Then they doubtless have the same handicap on the planet," Wanderer said slowly. "We can do what their machines never can. They must be glad we came." "They are, they are," Yukiko exulted. "They sang to us." "They want us to come live with them," Hanno cried. A kind of gasp went around the room. "Are you sure?" Svoboda's question was half demand. "Yes, I am. We've achieved some communication, and it's a simple message, after all." The words tumbled from Hanno. "How better can we get to really know each other and work together? They showed us the section we can have. It's plenty big, and we're free to bring over whatever we want, make whatever we like. The weight's enough to keep us fit. The air, the general conditions are no worse than in mountains we remember. We'll get used to that, and we can set up cozy retreats. Besides, we'll spend a lot of time in space, exploring, discovering, maybe building." "No," said Wanderer. The single sound was a hammerfall. Silence echoed behind it. Eyes sought eyes. One by one, faces stiffened. "I'm sorry," Wanderer went on. "This is marvelous. I'm tempted. But we've sailed too many years with the Flying Dutchman. Now there's a world for us, and we're going to take it." "Wait, wait," Yukiko protested. "Of course we mean to study Xenogea. Mainly it, in fact. It, the sapients. They must be why the Aloi have lingered. We'll establish bases, work out of them." Dushan shook his heavy head. "We'll build homes," he answered. "It is decided," Patulkia said. "We will cooperate with the Aloi when we have seen to our needs. I dare say we can investigate the planet better, living on it, than in a series of junkets." "Be that as it may," he smiled coldly, "je suis, je reste." "Hold on," Hanno argued. "You talk as though you mean to stay on permanently. You know that was never the idea. Xenogea may be habitable, but it's far from what we had in mind. Eventually we'll take on fresh antimatter. I think the Aloi have a production facility near the sun, but in any case they'll help us. We'll go to Phaeacia as we intended." "When?" challenged Mahandal. "When we're finished here." "How long will that take? Decades at least. Centuries, possibly. You two will enjoy them, and the rest of us sure will be fascinated. We'll help whenever we can. But meanwhile, and mainly, we have our own lives and rights. And our children's." "If in the end we leave," Svoboda said low, "it will not be the first home any of us forsook. And first we will have had a home." Hanno kept at her gaze. "You wanted to explore," he recalled. "And I shall. In a living land. Also, we need every pair of hands. I cannot desert my comrades." "You're outvoted," Aliat said, "and this time you can't do anything about it." She reached to stroke fingers over Hanno's cheek. Her smile quivered. "There are seas down there for you to sail on." "Since when were you a bold pioneer?" he taunted. She flushed. "Yes, I'm a city girl, but I can learn.
Do you suppose I liked lolling useless? I thought better of you. Well, in the past I crossed deserts, mountains, oceans. I survived in alleys, through wars and plagues and famines. Go to hell. No, please, we must not quarrel, Yukiko pleaded. Right, Wanderer agreed. We'll take our time. Think. Talk this over like friends. Hanno straightened so that he floated upright before the cliff in the sky. If you want, he said bleakly. But I can tell you now, in the teeth of your old tribal hope for a consensus, we won't reach any. You're bound and determined to strike roots on the planet, and I will not throw away this opportunity the Aloy have offered. I cannot. Instead of fighting, let's plan how we can make the best of what's to be. Dushan's countenance twisted. Yukiko, he croaked. She flew to his arms. He held her close. What she gulped forth was, forgive me. 30. I think you should go, Makandal said. It seems to be something you'd understand best among us. No, really, Aliat began. You've always... Makandal smiled. You've gotten too shy, honey. Think back, way back, like to New York. Still, Aliat hesitated. She wasn't simply unsure whether she could deal with the Ethagene in what was clearly a critical situation. As a matter of fact, she had gotten more grasp of their language and ways, in some aspects at least, than anybody else. Had her earlier life made her quick to catch nuances? But Dushan could ill spare her help, nursing the fields through this season of a drought year. And in spare moments she was collating the mass of data and writing up the significant experiences that Wanderer and Svoboda sent back from their exploration of the northern woodlands. "I'd have to stay in touch with you anyway," she said. "Well, that's wise," the other woman replied. "But you'll be on the spot, and the only one really qualified to make decisions. I'll support you. We all will." She was not the boss at Hestia. Nobody was. Yet it had tacitly come to pass that her word carried the most weight in the councils of the six. More lay behind that than finding the advice was sound. Wanderer had remarked once, "I think we, with our science and high technology, 4 1/3 light centuries from Earth, are discovering old truths again. Spirit. Mana. Call it what you will. Maybe even God." "Besides," Makandal continued, "I've got my hands full." She always did. Her own work, what she shared with Patulcius, what belonged to the community. And in 3 years, Joseph was several hands full by himself. End of side 14. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.